You dare. Yeah.
You want to start?
Oh, thank you, Dick, and hi, everybody. My name's Sandy, and I'm an alcoholic. I don't know why I always get to start.
You'll find out.
Bob and I get together and decide, what the outline's going to be, and we'll get together and have a meeting. And the only thing that gets decided is that I go first, and then we cancel the meeting and go home. Anyway, we're delighted that you came. I'm supposed to go to Philadelphia next week, and I just canceled it. So it makes me feel good that you all came to Tampa. I'm sure happy, because at least I can travel locally right now. Now, I'm supposed to get a procedure next month, and maybe that'll fix me, and I'll be back on the planes. Getting out there, talking about this great program, and starting to incorporate more history into it. I think the last time we talked here, I told you that I grew up hating history. In school, I wouldn't take it. I remember turning to my friend and I said, "It already happened. What the hell do I want to study that for?" I was very contemptuous of it. And what? Oh, you need the mic closer? Thank you. And as a result, when my friend Hal Marley and some of the other guys from Washington, D.C. every year would say, "Do you want to go up and meet Bill Wilson? Go up to the New York dinner. It's only, a short trip." I'd go, "What do I want to meet Bill Wilson for?" I need money. That was all I thought about. I had six kids, and I needed money. I didn't need to meet Bill Wilson, unless he gave out money, but I heard he did. I found out later he was pretty generous. And of course now, God, wouldn't that be something to have in your memory, an autograph or something like that? But once I took a look at some of our AA history books, after I got about 10 years, I suppose, I started seeing the spirituality of our program in the third dimension. It just became apparent that Alcoholics Anonymous was not planned by anyone. It was a happening. The only way to explain AA is it just happened. And it happened in the most remarkable fashion, never following the plans of our leaders, especially Bill. He'd come up with a plan and it would go the opposite way. And I suppose the best example is when he, like myself when I was new, realized that the key factor was money. that was what, if you're going to start a program, you need money. And so that's what he was after. And when they finally got that meeting with Rockefeller, and he could smell the money, and when Rockefeller studied us, he concluded that money would ruin it. Now, that was not good news for the people who had plans for how AA should turn out. Is it still can't hear?
No.
Oh. If I was thinking of something tonight that there's one thing that makes AA spiritual more than any other thing. Alcoholism is fatal. That may be the biggest reason that AA is spiritual. It kills people. And when you are confronted with that reality, sometimes you get an open mind in order to stay alive. And you try something you never would have tried unless it was fatal, unless There was no choice. We had a guy up in D.C., Buck Doyle. He was Mr. Northern Virginia AA. God, what a great guy, Irish guy. He was born unselfish. He never hardly talked about the steps. He was just helping people every minute, and he assumed everybody else would too. And my friend Hal used to criticize that Buck. He doesn't even hardly talk about the steps. I said, well, he's too busy 12-stepping people. It took me years to figure out that he was where we were trying to get by working the steps. But he told the story on himself. He came from a big Irish family, and his uncle had cirrhosis of the liver and was really in bad shape. And so Buck went to talk to him. Buck was still drinking, but he was going to try and talk his uncle into going to AA. And his punchline was, "Uncle, when my liver gets as bad as yours, I'm going." And then the crowning blow was when the doctor told him that if he kept on drinking, he was going to die. And one year, the doctor added one word to that sentence. He said, "You're going to die soon." And suddenly, he became interested in the program Alcoholics Anonymous. So I would submit that one of the things that makes this and keeps us spiritual, one of the interesting things is that when we get sober, we make no progress whatsoever in not being powerless. You're just as powerless with 25 years sobriety, just as vulnerable as the day you came in. We are always in the situation of needing help, need to be receiving help. We focus a lot on giving help, and it feels good and all of that, but it's as the years go on and you get more time, it's harder to ask for help. You feel like you should have the answers already, and you know, to call somebody up and go, "I'm having a hard time, I need help. So that's another thing that keeps it spiritual, is that there's never a time that you don't need God's help. You never achieve a position where you can rely on self-sufficiency. And I know Dr. Tebow, he had a hard time with that. He just felt that we carried this too far, that we would never be self-sufficient. That's when he was giving Bill a hard time about alcoholics not being mature. Drove Bill crazy. That's why the history book was called AA Comes of Age. We're mature. And then the more the international conventions and the General Service Conference, AA grows up. AA matures. And Dr. Tebow would go, "Well, not from my perspective. I haven't seen anything new." And it's my own personal opinion. That's where the "I am responsible" statement came from. Everybody in the room said, "I am responsible." So he went back to Tebow. "See that? We all said we're responsible. So how grown up can you get?" Well, I'm not sure a slogan makes you a grown up. So this weekend, we're going to be talking, we just tried to look at the program from different angles. And so Bob's going to tomorrow talk about the steps coming into the big book, and I'm going to talk on them coming into the 12 and 12 and the differences and what motivated Bill to even include them. He could have just written the 12 traditions. I mean, that was what it was all about, the grapevine articles. We got to get the 12. But something made him want to take another look at the steps for whatever reason. So we'll have a talk on that. And also, we're going to spend some time on the Oxford group. And I learned a few things that I didn't know by doing a little research. So we'll have some fun with that. And I'm drawing a blank, so I'm going to turn it over to the famous speaker of Founders Day this year. He left Founders Day, went to Australia, spoke every day for 20 days, and came here directly, still catching his breath, Bob.
I'm Bob, I'm an alcoholic. And I am here, and I am a little fried. I traveled 30 hours yesterday. But I'm here because this is my very favorite thing in the world, is to be with Sandy and to do something like this. He brings out the best in me. And I think he is at a point of clarity that we are the benefactors of his wonderful use of language and his insight, which I think is better than, well, it's to my liking, it is better than anything else being done today. There was a guy on the General Service Board by the name of Bernard Smith, who was an attorney, and there were a number of men on the board that were strong men that could push Bill at times when Bill needed a little pushing. And he pushed Bill pretty hard to come up with a 12 and 12. But Bill was, I perceive from some of the conversations, was procrastinating during that period, and he was really depressed. It was at kind of the peak of his depression. And at the talk in 1955, when AA comes of age, and that book has, you know, many of the talks written out that people presented, you know, our book AA comes of age, it has some selection, but Bern Smith said that AA is not a success story. It is a story of colossal human failure transformed into the most useful kind of happiness by that divine alchemy, the loving grace of God. And the last couple of years, I've been reading a lot of stuff on spirituality. Our story, we keep, so we are verbal people, and we are people of our story. Our story is kind of like the story of Christmas. It is this profound transformation of our lives. But I want for a moment to point out what Sandy pointed out also. It is the story of colossal human failure. As much as it is, now we often talk about that early part, what it was like, you know, and, you know, there's some tales of that. But that's equally as important, is the surrender. And I think sometimes we give that short shrift, because without the collapse of ego, there would be no surrender. So the process, this is the story of St. Paul. This is the story of the Iliad. I mean, this is our story. It's an epic story, which has been happening throughout mankind forever. The gift, and you hear people say, you know, I'm grateful that I'm an alcoholic. And normies don't understand that because it seems like kind of a funny thing. But most of us mean our lives are better since we've recovered than they would have been had we never had the disease. Mm-hmm. But the gift is the transformation, not an improvement, not a piece of information. I mean, it is what Jung talked to Hazard about, okay? It is a complete turnaround, where the fundamental ideas are all of a sudden cast aside, as Jung said, and replaced by a new set of ideas. And for people who knew us in our cups at our worst and see us relatively shortly after we have recovered, it's what Silkworth talked about, like they're almost not the same person. And if we've ever seen a person who's unfortunate enough to have a relapse, if you see them after a week or so of drinking, it is almost as if they are not like the same person. So our strength is what Paul, you know, the Apostle Paul talks about as our weakness. You know, we should. And the only hope might have been to run a donkey and go to Damascus if your life was as much trouble as our lives were in. But we have, through the gift that's been given through Bill Wilson and Dr. Bob, we've been given a way to replicate a spiritual awakening. Now, I mean, that is unbelievable. I mean, that is, it isn't just like we have a shot. to cure, you know, to deal with the physical aspects of alcoholism, we've been given a program that allows the replication of spiritual awakening. And we are a pretty rugged, rough, flawed group of people. It is not in the hands of experts. It is not in the hands of the trained. I love our history. When I went to Australia, I did not know when they asked me that I was going to have to give history talks. I thought I was just giving AA talks, which I can do. History talks, I found out, are a little bit more difficult. And because it was their Founders' Day also, and they wanted to hear the story of Christmas, and so I had to give three. I had to give three history talks, so it was a little bit different. There's a saying in medicine called ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny, which means that the development of the human, the development of the embryo in the body of the woman, when it's developing, is similar to the overall development of the entire human race. You know, there's a, I think, a period where it has gills. There's a, I mean, there's just evolution. In our fellowship, our history is like the development of an individual alcoholic. I mean, it is this, this near tragedy, this almost driving the bus off the cliff, this, you know, seconds and inches sort of thing that is the story. I mean, when you tell the history, if you, if we were able to condense our history and tell that story, it would be very much like the individual story of the alcoholic who just, a Max Sennett kind of a sort of thing where they just did it in time. And I want to give you one example of that. And there are many, so Sandy and I may go back and forth about it's obvious when Jung talked to Hazard. And our fellowship is full of people who come in and out that don't have anything much to do with Alcoholics Anonymous after they've made their contribution. Hazard was a man that, you know, from what I understand, did not maintain his sobriety throughout his entire life. He was a man that had a very important role in our fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. As to Debbie, but Silkworth. So this is a little bit out of chronology. So before Bill's going on the trip to Akron, Silkworth gets him aside, and Bill's kind of down because he's worked with 75 people and no one got sober. So my point is that everything in our history is spiritual because the story is spiritual. There is nothing that is not, and it's kind of like the way we view our own lives. If you're sober and you've got a program going, when you look backwards, you're not looking at the events so much anymore. You're looking at how they kind of are woven into the fabric of your recovery. And, you know, Sandy talks about his story, his history, and how that got altered at a period of time. So Silkworth gets a hold of Bill. Bill's complaining. Silkworth tells him that he's preaching. People are not interested in him, he and his tambourine. That he had to get more serious about talking about the illness, you know, and once he beats them up with the illness, that then they might be more open, as Sandy talked about when death starts to speak. Silkworth was a neurologist. He was, you know, and the only reason he's at Towns Hospital was the depression. He lost all his money. He lost his position at the hospital, and he ends up working for $100 a week at Towns Hospital. I mean, he's there because his life has been turned upside down. Now, what if we didn't have that man? Okay? So, I mean, that man was there because of a tragedy that happened in his life. And he's, you know, about 2 months ago, I was in New York. Towns Hospital is at 293, you know, Central Park West, up in about 89th. And, I went there. I used to have Towns Hospital on the lintel of the building, and now it doesn't have it anymore. They've taken it off because it's a residential building. But that moment, the only reason we got Silkworth, and could we have had another physician who was humble enough that when Bill said, I've had this experience, what should I do? Mm. I think the majority of doctors would have said, you're hallucinating, don't worry about it. Yes. Yeah, it's something about, you're on medication, don't, you know. But Silkworth had enough insight. He had read about spiritual awakening. He said, I don't understand it, but I'm familiar with it from the literature. And he said, whatever it is, hang on to it. So he had enough humility to be able to say, I don't know exactly what it is, but something's happened to you. You're different. Hang on to it. So.
Oh, I didn't know. I was all through. Okay. If you want to hear a real good assessment of the points that we're trying to make, listen, Lee has Norm Alpe's tapes, Seconds and Inches, and Clancy does a good replica of that talk. And it's just a series of incidents where if this guy hadn't been there at that exact moment, there'd be no AA. If he'd been earlier, I mean, and it just goes through all these coincidences in our history that you end up seeing that this was something that was planned by our Creator, who probably looked and said, man, since the beginning of time, the alcoholics have never had a shot. All throughout all these thousands of years, they have been excluded from society. They get locked up. Their lives are just horrible. And along comes this miraculous program that not only enables us to not drink, but enables us to see the world in a way that is miraculous. I don't know if I can remember that. I always like, there's a quote about AA, and I screwed up, but I'll try it again. I think it's Ernie Kurtz, but I can't find it anywhere. So if anybody knows where this came from. But it goes in an almost magical fashion. Alcoholics Anonymous was able to give its religious and non-religious members alike a view of the universe and their place in it that was both exciting and spiritual. In doing so, they borrowed from religion everything that was powerful and uniting while politely declining everything that was self-serving and conflicting. You might call it the spiritual heist of the century. And they did it all unconsciously without realizing it. Isn't that beautiful, capturing the whole thing? They did it all unconsciously without realizing it. And, you know, a lot of times when we have spiritual events happen to us, it isn't until a year later that we see the significance of it. Or other people will see it in us before we see it in ourselves. And they just go, Mary, are you on a diet? Are you... You just look so happy, and you look so, what are you doing? What are you doing? And, well, I'm going to AA. Really? And it makes you look like that? Yeah, I guess it does. And, well, what do you do there? Maybe I'll try it. Oh, Scott, it's the most exciting thing in the world. We have like a meeting. There'll be 30 of us, and we'll pick one of us as a leader, and they'll come up with a topic like resentment. And then we each go around the room and talk about resentment, and then we say the Lord's Prayer and go home. It's the most amazing, wonderful... It's the most wonderful thing in the world. And, of course, you could talk about AA to someone who's never been till the cows come home, and you could never have them catch on what's going on, but invite them to one open meeting where they come and hear a couple speakers and watch the audience and the way they react and watch the socialization afterwards. And people are yelling and they're doing, well, let's go out to dinner. We're gonna, and then they'll understand. They'll see it. They'll experience the spiritual energy themselves, but there's no way of communicating it. It just doesn't seem to work that way. We've, for the last year, had a lot of fun having a history meeting here in Tampa. I see Monica back there. We just got through the problem that Roman Catholics caused AA. And Monica knows the Pope personally, so she gives us the inside scoop on the Roman Catholics. And this has been a lot of fun. We started out just having into topics each week, but we ended up doing a book study on Not God by Ernest Kurtz, which is the best history book that I think has been written about AA. A lot of people hear the title and they go, Not God? Oh, he doesn't like God? And the title comes from this quote where it says, the alcoholic has to realize that he's not God. And that's where it comes from. And it's just so well written, and I think we're about 70 pages into it. And we've got new people and old-timers, and read a few paragraphs and then start talking about what we just read. And sometimes just two paragraphs will take 40 minutes of discussion where somebody will know something about this and that. And the part we were reading, just so you, maybe I'll get you to read the book, is Clarence Snyder, who's one of AA's greatest characters. I mean, he's way up there in terms of being one of our greatest characters. He probably is the world's champion 12-stepper, unless you count Dr. Bob with all the people that came through the hospital, but he didn't find all those people. Clarence went out and found them and brought them down to the hospital. And for some unknown reason, he ended up with a bunch of Catholics from Cleveland coming down to the Oxford group meeting in the Williams house. And as the Catholic men started getting better, their priests started inquiring because they'd seen how drunk they were all this time. And they said, what are you doing, John? What are you doing, Mike? Oh, Father, we're going to a thing down in Akron. It's really helping us to stay sober, and we love it. What is it? The Oxford group. Son, that's a Protestant organization. And if you keep going there, we may have to excommunicate you. So it was heavy duty back then. I remember I grew up Catholic, and the first joke I heard was they were given a tour of heaven, and St. Peter went, oh, here's the Jewish people, and here's the black people, and here's the Italian people, here's this, and then he went by a group of people, and then he started picking it up again, here's the Protestant, here's that, and he said, what was that? And he said, that's the Catholics, they think they're the only one up here, so we don't say we don't make any noise when we go by there. Well, it seemed that a guy from Cleveland had just gotten sober. He was down in the hospital, and it was customary then when you went to Oxford meetings that the wives went with him. The husband and wife went to the meeting. And Clarence was driving back to Cleveland, and the wife and some others were in the car, and he was going, boy, I've got to get a meeting up in Cleveland. We've got to do something with this Oxford thing. I've just stopped being Oxford. And the book had, the mimeograph, lithograph of the book had just been circulated, and the title was Alcoholics Anonymous. And Clarence said, I can start a meeting called Alcoholics Anonymous. And but I don't have any place to have it. So this guy's wife's thinking, my husband's going to be coming out of treatment soon. If there's an AA meeting in his own house, he'll have to go. She said, why don't you use our house? And she said, well, that's wonderful. So they have the house set up. And Clarence goes back next week and tells Dr. Bob, who was his sponsor, that they will not be coming back anymore from Cleveland, that we're going to start our own group up there and we're going to call it Alcoholics Anonymous. And Dr. Bob said, no, you can't do that. And it was the next night, and the entire, we're just reading this in the history book, the entire contingent from Akron went to that meeting and tried to break it up, tried to stop it from occurring because they didn't want to break away from the Oxford group that soon. In New York, the Oxford people were glad to get rid of the drunks in New York, but in Akron, they were very close. They were very close. And so because of those Catholics, this meeting got started, and it enabled Clarence to technically claim that he started the first AA meeting in the world. And as years went on, he just said, "I started AA." And he became the founder of AA, much to the chagrin of Bill Wilson. He couldn't stand Bill. He never thought we should be centralized. If he had his way, he had already written pamphlets way ahead of New York. He had pamphlets on everything. There's a book about his life, on sponsorship, on taking somebody into hospital, on intergroups, how intergroups should function, and setting them up. And his idea was that as AA evolved, there would be large centers, you know, like Chicago and Los Angeles and big cities, and they would do their own thing. There would be nobody in charge of all of AA. We wouldn't have a pamphlet that was written that everybody in AA read. It would be written at the local level. And sometimes I think he had something going there. Don't get me started. I have a nickname, the pamphlet Nazi. What the hell have we got this thing for? Wow. We got a pamphlet for short cobblers. I guess they got unique problems that none of us have. Can you take that off the tape, Lee? I don't know. There'll be some delegate in here that'll give me hell. Okay, that's all I have, Bob. I'm ready.
In some way, you discredited the Catholics with greatly expanding Alcoholics Anonymous. I think that. I'm going to talk about two or three things that are historical, that are part of our spiritual story. Ebby, I always think what a wonderful, loving thing it was that Bill Wilson referred to Ebby throughout his entire life as a sponsor. Ebby only stayed sober 29 months at first. He was living with Bill and Lois. He got drunk. Not too long after that, Bill and Lois lost the house. And then Ebby never really regained much sobriety in a 1950. Around 1953, Ebby went down to Texas and was down in Texas for about 9 years, and he got 7.5 or 8 years of sobriety in Texas. Came back to New York in 1962. He died, I think, late in 1964 with about 2.5 years of sobriety. Ebby never really got it. It was fascinating to me as you hear these certain stories. Or if he got it, he could not communicate it. Bill in the Big Book talks about, first of all, I think in modern day, if your sponsor got drunk and stayed drunk over that period of time, you would not have referred to him as your sponsor, as a current thing, and Bill did. And I think Bill understood without question that he would not, without the contribution of Ebby Thatcher, we would not have Alcoholics Anonymous and he would not be sober. That he was the instrument through which God chose to act. Period. End of story. And the closeness of those two men, that for 2.5 years they lived in the same home. You know, Bob talked about, you know, from June to August, Bill stayed in Dr. Bob's home. And most nights they stayed up till 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning. Do you remember those days when you sit up all night? I mean, we used to go to an open house, and then we'd bring our wives would have to carpool home. We would stay up till 6 or 7 in the morning just talking AA. I mean, it was just, we were just, you know, kind of full of it. And, well, that's not exactly what I meant. There's a different way of looking at that. I wonder if there ever would have been a better time in the world to start Alcoholics Anonymous than during the 30s.
Yeah.
That's a Great Depression. I wonder why, if people say, why now, if throughout time... And I don't know if there was, first of all, I think in order for an idea this big to be received, there has to be a level of consciousness to receive it. If God is pitching it, there has to be enough people with enough conscious, spiritual consciousness to catch it. And after the Roaring Twenties, the Depression beat people down into a point, I think, of reasonableness and humility, that probably as a society, we were more receptive than we ever would have been at any other point, less full of ourselves than we ever would have been at any other point, where all your dreams, people were losing their farms, their homes, their businesses. They had, I mean, there was no money, bread lines. It was everywhere. It was endemic. I mean, remember, just go back to 2008, how tough that collapse was, or most of us knew someone who was in trouble or couldn't have a job or, you know, all that sort of thing. But think of it. Systemically, the 30s were an enormously pregnant time spiritually. Christian Science, Unity Movement, Fillmore, Science of the Mind Church, I'll think of it. But that was the one that Chuck was involved with, you know, the Church of Religious Science, and I was trying to remember the Holmes. Ernest Holmes was the man. Emmett Fox, the Theosophony Society with Krishnamurti. There was this upheaval of spiritual interest. And again, I believe an upheaval of spiritual interest because people were getting grounded. I mean, as a society, we were in significant pain. And now we have a group of people who are birthing Alcoholics Anonymous, most of which do not have jobs. And they are able, they have the time for each other. You know, like there was one car in the New York group where, you know, most of the people were unemployed. So they literally, when they incubated this and gave each other, they only had like one meeting a week, but they got together almost every night of the week and shared. They were like an organism that was birthing this thing. And the message, every great movement needs a writer. Every great movement needs someone who can put down, and Bill was our man. Bill was the man through whom, you know, Bill in his fit of depression, lying in his bed, you know, took a yellow tablet and took the 6 steps of the Oxford group where you were had to admit that you were licked. You had to do an inventory, a depth that you'd never done before. You had to confess it to another person. You had to make restitution. You had to work with others, and you had to put God into every aspect of your life. Those were the kind of the 6 steps, and then the 4 apps of the vanity, purity, and selfishness, and love were some of the tenets of the Oxford group. And Bill, you know, the magic, I mean, for those of us that have studied the history, as wonderful as what they kept out of the Oxford group is what's wonderful of what they didn't keep out of the Oxford group. We are alive today as much for what they did not include in that process. I mean, shortly after Cleveland separated from the Oxford group, you know, Bookman talks about Adolf Hitler as being not too bad a guy. And, you know, and that went viral. Not too long after that, they changed their name from the Oxford group to Moral Rearmament. You know, and had we been as closely connected with them as Bookman was, he kind of got discredited, and I think it could have been the death blow of Alcoholics Anonymous if that was our identity. And so it's just funny how all these things kind of interact and kind of go down. But Bill's in his bed, when I get depressed, I'm having my imaginary ulcer attack. And he's with his legal pad, and he says, I know I have to expand these 6 steps a little bit. And when he expanded them into the 12 steps that we have today. And when he was done, he said, 12, I kind of like that number. And the only changes that came in those steps were the first step, I think they changed the word I to we. And then they, you know, they in the seventh step, they took humbly on our knees out, holding nothing back out. And then later, after about the third printing of the book, they changed spiritual experience to spiritual awakening. But other than that, there was absolutely no change in the 12 steps. And here's this man in a fit of depression, you know, 4 years sober. And again, you know, we all have a lot of opinions about depression and pain. Sandy suffered a heck of a lot of physical pain the last 3 or 4 years. But pain also opens us in a way that, you know, it suppresses the ego if we allow it to do its work. If we fight it, we often don't do that very well. And that's, I think, again, the story of our program. Out of the worst of times, Bill Wilson was able to come through with some of the best things that we have in our history.
Well, we're getting near the end. I'd have one thing. Our friend Dick Anderson won't be, he called me, he was unable to make it tomorrow night to be our speaker. But we have a wonderful man that's replacing him, our friend Red Dog from Alaska. Yeah. Any of you people that are pilots in this room, you talk to him. He's got more flying stories about flying up in Alaska where you can do anything you want. You know what I mean? The FAA can't track you up there. It's a great place to fly. And he's flown more airplanes than you can imagine. And the stories that he has, I've known him for quite a few years, and I just sit back and go, holy jeez, I thought I had some good stories. So we're very grateful, Red Dog, for that, and I'm delighted. And I want to acknowledge my daughter, Conway. She just arrived today to come down and help me for a month.
Stand up.
And she just celebrated 11 years in AA, so... So getting back to the Catholics, when they were printing the mimeograph, I call it mimeograph, I don't know
lithograph.
If that's lithograph of the big book, Bill decided that he wanted to circulate it to the outside world and get feedback on it. And there was this one Catholic guy in New York. He was probably the only one. For some unknown reason, Cleveland had a bunch of them, but New York just had the one. And he was well connected.
He must have built St. Patrick's.
Yeah, he built St. Patrick's.
All by himself. Yeah,
and so he took it to the Catholic Committee on Publications. Because they were very worried because it came out of the Oxford group, which the church was completely down on. But AA had transformed things so much that they felt it was wonderful. They came back with rave reviews, except for one thing. At the end of Bill's story, he said, "I felt like I was catapulted into heaven." And the Catholic Church said, "We feel that we corner the market on heaven. So if you could substitute something." So he substituted utopia. And if you go to his story, you'll see utopias in there. A little bit later, when they had the book had been printed, and they were trying to decide how best to market it, Hank Parker's said, "We should take the last $500 that we have and we'll do a postcard shower, thousands and thousands of postcards to doctors east of the Rocky Mountains, because doctors know alcoholics and we'll tell them the sure cure for alcoholism, get this book, blah, blah, blah." And this same Irishman knew a radio personality named Gabriel Heater, who did these little interviews back in the 30s, and it was everybody listened. And he'd made arrangements to get interviewed by Gabriel Heater and to mention the book. So that was going to be the big plug. But he was having a hard time staying sober. And there was 2 weeks until the radio interview. Morgan Ryan, that's who it was, Morgan Ryan. So they got him a room in the downtown athletic club, and they had 24-hour-a-day guards from AA to make sure he didn't get drunk. He got on the program. He mentioned the book, Alcoholics Anonymous. They sent out the postcards, and they could hardly contain themselves to go down to the post office box to get all these things. So they waited about 3 days, and then Bill and Hank went down, and he looked through the glass, and there's like about 6 postcards. And their hearts fell, and Hank turned to Bill and said, "Bill, they can't put all those cards in that little box. There's mail bags full of them. Call the postmaster." And everything they got was in that little box, and there was, I think they got 2 orders. And right about that time, they got evicted from the house in Brooklyn. And Bill and Lois lived for the next couple of years at 70 different homes. People would loan them a car. They came up, taking up collections, giving $20 a week to live on. So, boy, we had some champions back there that we can think about that. It's amazing how they stuck in there, but we got people today that are devoting their lives to this in a way that is just, I look at my friend Dick over here, he moved up from Lauderdale. And as soon as he got here, he got on 2 or 3 committees, he started helping out the intergroup, and he goes to the jail meetings every single week. He takes a car load over there to the detox places, and he's older than I am. That makes me feel great. He's older than I am. So we still have our heroes today. I think we're at the end of the time. Take about a 10-minute break, and then this great documentary will be shown very shortly. Thank you all very much. Dick, you did good. Are you comfortable? Okay.
Great job.
How we doing?
Hey, Sammy. Sharon's friend, Jeff.
Oh, yeah, she told me. Yeah, hi, she told me you're coming.
I just love to hear your voice. It makes me so happy.
Wonderful. I'm going to just sit here for a while.
We've been praying for you.
Yeah, thank you. Boy, I'd like to get through this. Yeah. We may have, I just don't recall doing it.
Did the tombstone have Thatcher on it? Did it have the name Thatcher on it? Something close to that?
Oh, I don't remember that.
Yeah.
No, I'll be damned.
I think there's a picture of it.
Yeah, but I never saw Thatcher. I'm going to go look that up.
I think that's what caught Bill's attention, was the fact that the name Thatcher was on the tombstone.
Thank you. You told me something I didn't know.
Well,